Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. A recent story challenging the Indigenous heritage of singer-songwriter Buffy St. Marie sent shockwaves through Canada. It distressed many people, but it also ignited a debate regarding what it means to be Indigenous. On today's show, Alderville First Nation Chief Tanier Simpson will give his perspective. He will shed light on what it means to be Indigenous, but also share how the Alderville community determines who is a member and who is not. He will also explain how current federal policies regarding identity may impact the future of his people. I'm delighted to have with me today Alderville First Nations Chief Tanier Simpson. Welcome back to Consider This.
Well, thank you for having me.
What was your reaction when you first heard the Buffy St. Marie story by CBC challenging her indigeneity?
When I first heard it, it started a roller coaster of emotions. I think Buffy St. Marie tried to get ahead of the story by posting on her Facebook page how she heard that there was a story being done on her Indigenous heritage. And she basically said that she knows who she is and that she just didn't know where she was from. So I think we all wanted to believe her. We've all grown up with Buffy for the last 60 years. She's been one of our main entertainers and consolers and someone who we felt has spoken through us and for us, about us. When we did watch the CBC Fifth Estate documentary, it just seemed like that there was no recourse. There was no other way about it. Once all the evidence had been given, it looks to be that indeed she does not have any Indigenous heritage. So that raises the questions of what does that mean for us? Do we give her a free pass? Does fraudulent behavior have an expiry date because she's done so much? She's been adopted into the Paiapot First Nation. What does that mean? But a lot of people are just, they're very hurt. And when it comes down to the issue of pretendianism, it causes damage and harm to our communities because she did mean so much to our people. We put a lot into her. She's been with us for most of our lives. All of my life, my parents loved her. We have her records. So it's caused a lot of pain. So I think that it went from denial to acceptance to pain. And then the question is how do we move forward?
I'd like to talk about all those questions one at a time. So let's just explore a little bit more about reaction. How about the reaction from those around you? What sort of things were you hearing from others in the community or others that surround you?
Well, I think initially it was almost unanimous. Everyone was behind Buffy. They couldn't believe this. CBC should be ashamed of themselves. It just seemed like too much. But then when it started to sink in, some people accepted it. Some people refused to watch the documentary. But then word was getting out like, oh, this looks serious. This looks real. Some people say that they will always love Buffy. They love her music. Others are saying, well, she's been pretending to be us. She's been using our marginalization as her cover and her protection and to profit off of this fake heritage. So what does it mean? And then I was thinking, well, if she truly honestly didn't know her birthright, then I'd be willing to, you know, to let it go. But in the documentary, it's like there should have been no doubt. She was like 20 years old, her whole life as a white individual growing up in America. And then to see at the end of the documentary how she used threatening against her biological brother. Now, she made allegations. I can't say one way or the other if they were true or not. But it definitely looked like she had a lawyer write all of this up. So it's not that she just didn't know. She actively would have been pushing this fraud her whole career. And then once you're doing it for so long, you can't really go back. So even if she maybe wanted to come clean, or she just didn't have, she was in too deep. And that's my guess, that she got in too deep to turn back.
For some, outing people who say they are Indigenous but are not is very important. Why is that important?
Well, in the case of Buffy St. Marie, she's taking up space and airwaves and accolades and awards and recognition that was intended for real Indigenous artists. So it's making it harder for legitimate Indigenous artists to get ahead. And so when she wins the Juno for Indigenous music, or if she wins like the best Indigenous album of the year, or song of the year, that should rightfully be going to a legitimate Indigenous artist. So she is taking up this space and not being recognized in the way that she should be. Like, she is a fine singer. She's a great folk singer. She probably could have made a career not being selling herself as an Indigenous artist. And yeah, I guess that's, I hope that answers your question.
There have been a number of people who have undergone this kind of scrutiny, such as Joseph Boyden, Michelle Latimer, Carrie Bourassa, among others. Is the Buffy St. Marie story different? And if it is, why?
Sadly, I don't think it is different. In a lot of ways, she follows the mold and the formula for being a pretendian, where she knows her true background. She has found some initial success being touted as an Indigenous person, artist, writer, whatever. And then they continue to produce a fake narrative about themselves, knowing that they're not true. And there's a lot of this inconsistencies. They always kind of point back to like, oh, we don't really know, you know, the records weren't kept very well. But that's a lie. With Indigenous people, there's so many records about us, like going back to the very like early 1800s. And we know our family lines intricately. So that doesn't pan out. She also has a different changing story. So they always have changing stories, and their experiences often just don't ring true. I mean, looking back now, like it's like, okay, well, I get it. I can see how that happened. But at the time, you don't go out and doubt someone's heritage. If they say that they're Indigenous heritage, you're not going out saying, hey, no, you're not. I need to know proof that you are. You just accept it, and then you will keep accepting it. And in the case of Buffy, like our whole lives, we've grown up with her. So it's just something that, you know, we never really expected. And of course, she looks Indigenous. That's the big thing. So we never really would have expected this revelation, but here we are.
You've said something really interesting, and it sounds like there's been a change in attitude amongst the Indigenous community towards this kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit more about what that shift has been and why it's significant and leading to what's going on right now?
Well, I guess if you go back like 100 years ago, when you have the example of Gray Owl, it seemed like such a crazy thing, such a crazy thing to happen. Like, wow, this one person pretended to be Indian and he wasn't, you know, that's huge. It turns out that that's very common. There's a lot of people that perhaps they like the romantic image of the noble savage, they would used to call it, living in the wilderness, you know, one with nature. So they bought into this romantic perception of Indigenous people. That's not necessarily the case. And it's different from who they are. And maybe it speaks to what their ideals are as a person, and they want to latch on to that. And it's so easy to say, like, oh, my great-great-great-grandmother was an Indian princess, which I've heard almost from, I'm not going to say everybody, but I hear that all the time. So everyone believes that they've got a little bit of Indigenous blood in them. So it gives them the in, basically, to take on that persona, even if they they don't know, or if they think that they're all white, there's a chance, hey, maybe I do have some Indian back in there. So it's okay to say this.
One of the more controversial aspects of the story is its reliance on a birth certificate. And as someone who has spent a career working with documents related to Indigenous people, can you share some of the challenges you face?
Well, you have to understand how the records are created. I'm not an expert on American birth certificates, but that expert that they had on the Fifth Estate, she knew how these records were created. She was able to authenticate that indeed, you know, this is it's the right format. And I think that the one proof that it's real was the fact that it was in a numbered sequence. It was given a file number in order. So if Buffy's story that, they issued it later, then it would have had a different number on it than the one that from the moment she was born, she got the birth certificate. So to me, from someone that understands records and knowing how these work, that makes sense. You wouldn't have been able to retroactively put that birth certificate into a sequence and that number being held for them. So that just that blows that part of the story that Buffy was trying to sell.
Can you explain to listeners what it is you exactly do with documentation and how you use documents in your business?
Well, in my work, for those that aren't aware, I started a research company called Wampum Records. We're a historical archival research company that has been contracted by the federal government to resolve claims against the Crown from survivors, where we go in and we have to make sure that the claims are true. So we have to go back into the records. We have to find the students' records. If it's residential school, we look at the admission and discharge records. We look at the quarterly returns. So these records are all being kept for internal purposes, not to prove like a litigation, 50 years in the future. But these records were kept for a reason. They're usually based on funding. So schools were funded on their nominal rolls, how many students were in there. So these were records that just had to be kept as daily housekeeping. So you know what they look like. They're standard forms, and the forms change through the years. So you know what a legitimate document is. And if a fake one were to pop up, you all types of alarm bells would be ringing, like maybe a 1980s form, but being filled out with your 1930s information, you would know right off the hop that's incorrect. So, and working up from government records, it's quite a bureaucratic system. They kept quadruplet copies of almost everything with Indian residential schools. So you would always probably be able to find the documents at some point.
I'd like to talk about this in a local context as well. How do you determine who is a member of the Alderville First Nation?
Okay, so there's two criteria that need to be met. You need to be a status First Nations, so that's Indian status under the Indian Act, and you also have to be a member of Alderville, usually by birthright, so your mother or your father or both were Alderville members, therefore you are born as an Alderville member. And in the past, we accepted transfers from other First Nations. So if you had, say, someone from Hiawatha who wanted to move to Alderville and transfer to become an Alderville member, we would basically have to ratify that through the community. If the community says, yes, we accept this person, then we would grant them Alderville membership, and vice versa, Hiawatha's membership would cease with them.
You say the community decides. How does that process take place? And is it have to be unanimous? Is there a percentage? How does that work?
Well, in the past, we don't do this anymore. It's been, I'm going to say 30 years since we've allowed it to happen, maybe 25, but it's been a long time. From what I understand, there was a community meeting. It would be discussed. The person trying to transfer would make their case to the community. And at that point, there would be a vote among the people in attendance if they would like to have this member join. And if they do, then it would have been ratified.
What's the role of marriage in determining whether a person is a member of the Alderville First Nation?
Well, if you're looking prior to Bill C-31 in the mid-1980s, if you were an Indigenous status person and you were to marry a non-Indigenous woman, she would be granted status, and vice versa. If Indigenous First Nation status woman married a non-Indigenous man, she would lose her status. So Bill C-31 was created to correct that issue, and women who lost their status got it back. But Bill C-31 also introduced a second two-generation cutoff rule where they put in two levels of status. Your 6-1 and your 6-2. 6-1s with a child would be able to have a status child, and they would become a 6-2 if they married a non-Indigenous person, or a 6-1 if they were marrying an Indigenous person with status. So this has led to decreased numbers of status children being born, because there is a lot of marrying out or marrying non-status First Nations or Métis people. So it's one of those things that marriage doesn't really play a role as much as who the parents are on the birth certificate.
How does that impact then the First Nation itself then, as you know, generations continue to move forward? Does it diminish your numbers? How does it impact overall?
Well, that's a very good question. We've done a few studies. The studies have actually shown that in the future, there will no longer be any status Indians born in Alderville. The number keeps getting pushed back, but we know that unless things change, status Indians will disappear from Canada at some point because of this. And that was always the intent of the government. They're always trying to eliminate Indians. So if they were able to do it this way, then they could. So that's the harm of Bill C-31 is it was introduced to correct what they saw as an injustice, but they actually put more injustice into it. So we understand it's a problem. So I mean, strategically, like if you're an Indigenous person, like especially a 6-2, and you want your children to have status, you would have to marry someone who has 6-1 or 6-2 status on the reserve. You can only pass your land and property down to a member of Alderville. So if you no longer have status children, you are not able to leave your estate to your children. And this is becoming a big problem where residents, the members are passing away and they have no status members to pass on their property to.
Is there an active advocacy going on to correct this?
Not enough. There's murmurs, there's talk, but we need action right now, because we know something like this is going to take 25 years in the courts once we start an official formal process. So we really should be acting yesterday to address these issues. But there's so many issues facing First Nations in Canada right now. It doesn't seem like it's gone the given the importance that it's supposed to have. So someone's got to spearhead this, and if it's got to be Alderville, then I think we should do that.
You know, if there are cases where people have had their Indigenous identity questioned by the Alderville community?
Well, Alderville, everyone knows everyone's business. So we accept adoption. So if an Indigenous member couple adopted a child and they were granted status, we accept that. We accept them in. We know that they're not blood, but they are family. They become Alderville members, and we accept them as such. But really, you can't fake membership in Alderville. You have to be status. You have to be an Alderville member. So we have lots of Indigenous people in the area and in Alderville that aren't members. We would accept them unless, like, we have reason to believe you're making it up. Like, you don't question someone's claim to indigeneity. So unless CBC goes in and you know, starting an investigation on everyone who claims Indigenous ancestry, where we really don't have a way of figuring that out.
Because that's really a big aspect of Buffy St. Marie's story, is the idea of being adopted into the Piapot Cree First Nation family. How does that work? And is there any parallel between what you've just described to me from Alderville?
Well, to me, this sounds like adoption of convenience on Buffy St. Marie's part. She was in her 20s at the time that she was adopted by the chief and his wife. Obviously, she was looking for connections and basically that just the acceptance and formality of becoming Indigenous. So that provided to her. But usually you're not adopting 24-year-olds. She knew she wasn't. So yes, she became a member of the Paiute family at that point, but she had already been selling herself as an Indigenous artist for a few years until that point. So she got in on a lie and she was accepted on that lie. But she arguably has done a lot of good in her career. She's brought a lot of attention to the issues. A lot of people are saying that the good she has done for Indigenous peoples outweighs the original crime, the fraud that she's been committing. So, I mean, that's one argument. But at the same time, it's a fraud is a fraud. And we it's hard because we all love Buffy. Like, it's just, we're still grappling with it, even though it's been days. Like, we really loved her music. We loved her message. And it's just, it's hurting. And this is the damage that these pretendings do. They cause all this hurt and pain.
I want to ask you why Indigenous identity is so significant, but I want to do it in a certain context. As Indigenous communities settle treaties and there are payouts as part of reconciliation and a recognition for a need to make financial settlements, this places pressure on communities like Alderville to know who has the right to those monies. I know of this case in the United States where some Indigenous communities have faced trouble because they have a successful casino or other resources, and then they face questions of who has a right to access those monies. Do you see any evidence of this in Canada or anywhere across the country or in Alderville where this becomes a concern and Indigenous identity becomes part of being tied into this new wealth that's being created?
Well, that's a good question. As far as like status First Nations are concerned, it's very cut and dry about who's a member. And so I'd say for our issue, it's not the case. But when you get into settlements for Métis people, where to be Métis, all you have to do is say you're Métis and you're accepted. That's an issue. I'm not sure if you're aware of what's happening with this fake reserve called Ardoc First Nation, where it's just a bunch of non-Indigenous people who say we're making First Nation, we're calling ourselves a First Nation, we're giving ourselves a chief, and we're now trying to engage the federal government in claims and treaties and settlements. I know that there are a few Indigenous, non-status Indigenous members of this Ardoc First Nation, maybe looking for some. I'm not going to say they're trying to, you know, join the First Nation and not through any fault of their own, just because maybe other First Nations weren't accepting them. But the vast majority of Ardoc First Nation is non-Indigenous people. So that creates a real problem when these people start going out and speaking as Indigenous people, saying that they have rights to lands and territories and rights. So a lot of the settlement funds that we've gotten have been for loss of lands. 90% of reserve lands were taken since the reserves were set up. We were denied our hunting and treaty rights. So hunting and harvesting rights were denied to Alderville members, all Williams Treaty members, for 100 years illegally. So we received compensation for those loss of rights. So you have elders who were 90 years old for their whole life. They were denied their rights to their lands and to profit on land. And they were chased by game wardens and imprisoned and all this. So that's real damages that they were getting that settlement funds for. So if you somehow were actually not Indigenous and trying to cash in on that's a very horrible thing. So that's why we're concerned about the new Métis settlement agreement that's going through Ottawa right now for that reason. I might not want to get into it too much, but to us, it's very problematic.
You've talked a lot today about trauma and hurt amongst the Indigenous community. How does the community heal?
Well, we always come together in times of hardship, and there's been several different types of hardship in our people over the years. So we're used to being disappointed. We're used to being lied to. We're used to getting the short end of the stick. We're used to being marginalized. And so we get our strength from each other, from our members in Alderville and then our members in the Williams Treaty First Nations. And then it spreads out from there. Like we've all experienced the same issues from East Coast to West Coast. Like we might not be the same nations, have the same culture and society and language, but we have the shared commonality that we were Indians, as the government liked to call us. So we do come together and we're coming together further on this. And I'm going to say that there has been a shift in people's take on this issue. At first, we were all in denial. We didn't want to believe it. Then, you know, well, she was lying, but it wasn't really that bad. And now it's like, well, she was lying and it is really that bad. So everyone comes to it at their own time. But I think, you know, it's been just a few days, but who knows where we're going to be in a week or a month. What is the future of Buffy? We don't know. Is she going to still perform? Is she going to come clean? That's the big thing. I think if she were to come clean now, then we can all start healing. We can say, okay, phew, she's come clean. Now we can deal with it. But if she continues to sell this falsehood, then we're not going to be able to heal. We are still going to be in turmoil amongst ourselves about what this means. So Buffy owes it to all Indigenous people to come clean about this.
Chief Tanya Simpson, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you for having me, Robert.
That was Alderville First Nation Chief Tanya Simpson.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com. Or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.